screenings of short documentary films, performances of Cottonwood in the Flood, and much, much more. Again, the Vanport Mosaic Festival is May 27th through May 30th, celebrating the preservation of the history of Vanport and its residents, taking place all over the Portland metro area. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 4:59, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the evening news, followed by Labor Radio, and then Prison Pipeline. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Community College, inviting the public to meet finalists for the next PCC president. Forums held May 23rd through 27th at 4 campus locations. More information can be found online at pcc.edu/president-search.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a Baltimore police officer indicted in the death of Freddie Gray was acquitted of all charges today.
Local students marched through downtown Portland today in response to the Build a Wall banner put on display last week at Forest Grove High School.
And a new report from the Oregon Environmental Council found that diesel fuel costs the state $3.5 billion every year in health fees and lost productivity.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 23rd, 2016. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Lisa Loving. Late last week, Governor Kate Brown issued a cease and desist order against Bullseye Glass to immediately stop using several toxic substances in any uncontrolled furnace at the site. Air monitoring stations at a daycare center near Bullseye Glass found lead levels to be 400% over legal limits. The levels create an immediate short-term health risk to residents in the area, with children especially susceptible to lead exposure. The cease and desist order requires Bullseye Glass to stop the use of several pollutants for at least the next 10 days. The pollutants include lead, arsenic, cadmium, beryllium, chromium, cobalt, nickel, and selenium. Bullseye Glass has stated it is working on installing an air filtration system and expects to be compliant within the next few months. People can go to saferair.oregon.gov for more information.
The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality has released the first results from air testing conducted near the Southeast Portland Precision Cast Parts Company metal alloy plant. The results found significantly high levels of nickel and arsenic and above recommended levels of hexavalent chromium. Arsenic levels were 4 times over health-based recommended levels, and nickel was found to be 2 times higher than recommended. Spokespersons for Precision Cast Parts deny the arsenic is from their plant, stating the company does not use arsenic in its metal alloys. The company notified Oregon DEQ that they've installed 4 new air filters to supplement the 2 air filters the plant used previously. 1 new baghouse-type filter was also installed, bringing the total to 33 baghouse filters at the Portland plant site. The Oregon DEQ, in conjunction with the Oregon Health Authority, installed several air monitoring stations near the Precision Cast Parts plant earlier this year. Data from 2 other air monitoring stations near the plant will be collected and the information released to the public in mid-June. The annual Toxic 100 Air Polluters list, compiled by researchers at the University of Massachusetts, ranked Precision Cast Parts as America's #1 pollution emitter in 2013. Last year, the company was ranked as the 20th worst polluting company in the country.
A new report from the Oregon Environmental Council has found diesel costs the state $3.5 billion every year in health fees and lost productivity. Diesel exhaust is 100 times more toxic than gasoline exhaust, and the new report finds it is Oregon's worst air pollutant. It causes $274 million of climate change damage in Oregon annually. It's reported that diesel causes up to 460 premature deaths each year, as it is associated with cancer and can damage the heart, brain, and lungs. Yet Oregon has reduced its funding towards upgrading school buses, and the dirty buses continue to pollute neighborhoods. Oregon lags behind Washington, having only invested 5% of the funds Washington has towards diesel cleanup since 2002. Oregon also does not test the emissions of heavy-duty vehicles, unlike Washington and California.
Portland Police Chief Larry O'Day and Mayor Charlie Hales are facing criticism after O'Day shot his friend in a hunting accident in April. Critics from around the department are enraged the leaders waited almost a month to disclose the non-fatal accident. While hunting in eastern Oregon, O'Day shot his friend in the back with a .22 caliber rifle. The wounded man, who has not been named, but is described as a good friend of O'Day's, was airlifted from Harney County to a trauma hospital in Boise and treated for injuries. Reports indicate O'Day waited 4 days before alerting Hales, who was traveling in Europe at the time. As a storm of criticism has erupted, the mayor's spokesperson, Sarah Hotman, told the Oregonian that Hales was, quote, following standard policy and not going public with the story. Hales appointed O'Day in 2015 and, according to his spokesperson, is, quote, concerned with supporting a good man and good chief who is heartsick about hurting his friend. But retired officer Tommy Mack, a former police union president, went on record saying he's shocked and appalled at how the situation has been handled. Mack and others want the police leader, who passes judgment when other officers are involved in off-duty incidents involving firearms, to set a better example when involved with an accidental firearm shooting. Harney County deputies have yet to file a report detailing the incident. Investigations by the state police and Oregon Department of Justice are now underway, and the city auditor's independent police review division has opened a review into the case.
The Clackamas County Major Crimes Team is investigating a shooting involving two Oregon City police officers. Oregon City Police spokesman Sergeant Matthew Paschall says two officers were attempting to arrest a man at his home on Saturday. The department news release claims that the victim resisted and was shot. The unidentified victim's family and friends told the KBOO News yesterday that he had mental health issues and that police were serving a warrant for an unpaid traffic infraction. The man was pronounced dead when paramedics arrived at the scene. Tune into the KBOO News for more coverage on this case later in the week.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and the language we use to describe people with mental illness sometimes reflects a wider stigma against the conditions. Health officials say we can remove the shame associated with mental disorders by talking about them, as we do with other health conditions. Here to tell us more about the issue are KBOO reporter Emery Mort and Chris Boniff, Executive Director of the Oregon Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and experts say we should think twice the next time we call someone crazy or mentally ill. 1 in 5 adults experiences some form of mental illness in a given year, according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI. Chris Boniff, head of the Oregon Chapter of NAMI, says how we talk about it can negatively impact people who suffer from mental illnesses.
The language does contribute to the perception that these are permanent things, these are things that cause disability, these are things that if you encounter them in your life, if your family is affected by it, if you're affected by it as an individual, that there's no hope.
NAMI and other health officials say people should take a nuanced approach to talking about disorders by using people-first language. Boniff says the lack of people-first language is unique to discussions on mental health, where sufferers are frequently referred to as the mentally ill, instead of people with mental illnesses.
This is healthcare, and you don't walk around calling people the cancers or walk around calling people the heart diseased.
Most importantly, mental illnesses should be normalized so that people aren't afraid to seek treatment, Boniff says.
We know that if we get help to people quickly, we're very, very effective at preventing a mental health condition from getting worse.
This is Emery Mort with KBOO News.
Portland Public Schools passed a resolution last week mandating schools teach climate change in their curriculum as a fact rather than a theory. Specifically, schools are now required to address humans as a mechanism causing the phenomenon. Textbooks or class materials that present climate change as anything other than fact will no longer be used. Words such as likely and could are ubiquitous in science textbooks, and PPS officials say they should be replaced. The resolution received national attention and disapproval from conservative groups who view the change as a reflection of Portland's liberal political climate. Yet those in favor of the change see the issue as too urgent to treat as a possibility and see altering educational curriculum as key to spreading awareness and aligning with science.
What makes the world so divided? Is it politics? Is it social issues? Or is it something else? Dr. Sharon Schulman has coined a new term to describe how better communication could transform relationships and the world. Her book is called Freedom and Dialogue in a Polarized World, and she'll be speaking about it Tuesday at noon at Portland State University's Neuberger Hall, room 407. The talk is free to the public. KABU's Lisa Loving spoke with Dr. Schulman to get a preview.
Today in our polarized culture, we have a lot of people who want to be free to do as they please. We have a lot of people who are very sure that they are right and you would be much better off if you just agreed with them. And these two ideas of freedom just exacerbate all the problems. It leads to a world filled with a sense of, I have my rights. I believe in the right to live for a baby. I believe in the right to choose for a woman. That's the abortion debate right there. It's all about the autonomous freedom of someone to make a decision. So, and both sides think, of course, that they're completely right. They don't want to think about things from the other side's perspective. And I just looked at issue after issue after issue and realized that it all has a lot to do with how we think about freedom. We can think about freedom in a different way. And so I got fascinated with a particular Russian thinker who didn't write about freedom at all, I have to say. He wrote about language. Anyway, he had this idea about language being dialogic, and I thought, you know, when we make decisions, we take into consideration a lot of things. We take into consideration the people who are dear to us, what they would think of the decision, whether they would really applaud it or they'd be dubious or we would disappoint them. When we're making a decision, it's not just leave me alone to do as I please or I see the truth. It's more an interactive kind of dialogue between a person and other people or a person and the things that they hold dear or whatever. And so I got interested in trying to describe another way of thinking about freedom, according to which I feel more free not just to be left alone or to see the truth, but to the extent that I can see things from the perspectives of others and take into consideration how they think about things in a world that we share.
What I hear you saying is empathy is the key.
This Russian theorist who I'm so fascinated by said, empathy is very important, but pure empathizing, in which you get sucked into the pain of another and can only see what they see, renders you paralyzed to actually help them. All you can do is reduplicate their suffering. You have to keep one foot back in your reality and in your hope. This kind of empathy is very, very important and lacking in our polarized world today. The thing that I'm noticing lately is people are enjoying the hatefulness that they feel toward others so much more than even 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago. It's like everybody complains about polarization, but, I mean, not even so secretly, really enjoy it. We really enjoy sneering at those we consider to be stupid or wrong thinking. And what I'm trying to argue is that if you try to think about what's important to other human beings, how did they get there? How did they get to be thinking that way that's so alien? That will help you yourself be more free to think about things from multiple perspectives and make good decisions in your own life. And that until we feel like it's in our own interest to be more empathetic to others, honestly, we're not going to do it.
Sharon, what do you want people to do with these ideas? What is the desired result of your efforts here?
That's a great question. What I want is to see communities all over the country where people make an effort to try to be able to see things from other people's perspectives instead of wanting to just win. Right now, all we want to do is squash the bug and win in the ballot box, win in the courts, get something overturned or something into law to protect some right. We don't really want to understand each other. In my terms, I mean, as someone who studies literature and writes about it and everything, I'm hoping other people will see that this is interesting and will also think about it and write about it and agree or disagree with me and get a conversation going that a lot of people can be part of.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving. Local high school and college students marched through downtown Portland today in response to a banner two students put on display at Forest Grove High School last week that said, "Build a wall." The demonstration began at 12:30 at Pioneer Square, and students walked to Portland City Hall and Portland State University. The march kicked off with speeches by social justice activists Teresa Rayford and Jesse Sponberg. This follows a walkout at Forest Grove on Wednesday in support of Latino students, who make up a great percentage of students in the school district. Many people nationwide have expressed discontent with proposals made during this election cycle about how to deal with immigrants and non-whites. Specifically, Republican frontrunner Donald Trump's plan to build a wall has incited backlash from several organizations. The student who put up the sign at Forest Grove High School apologized, but this did not stop students from marching today. Students from Roosevelt, Lincoln, and other Portland public high schools attended and helped coordinate the event by passing out flyers and posting on social media.
Bernie Sanders won last week's Oregon Democratic presidential primary by a margin of 15 points over his opponent Hillary Clinton. However, a widely publicized poll before the election predicted almost the direct opposite results. A poll conducted by DHM Research and commissioned by Oregon Public Broadcasting in partnership with Fox 12 News forecast a Clinton victory by 15 points over Sanders. Given the actual primary results, the poll not only picked the wrong winner, but was off by around 30 points. When the poll was released a week before the Oregon primary, many people were surprised by the numbers. Sanders has enjoyed a very large and enthusiastic group of supporters, especially in the Portland metropolitan area, Salem, and Eugene. To find out how DHM Research could be so wrong in its polling, I spoke with John Horvick, DHM's vice president and political director. Horvick pointed out three challenging situations that made this election different from past ones. First, he said that over 100,000 voters switch parties to vote in the primaries. Oregon is a closed primary state, which means, for example, a voter needs to register as a Democrat to vote in the Democratic primary. Second, Horvick said the state's new motor voter registration system brought many more potential voters into the process. And finally, Horvick pointed to the poll's small sample size of only 300 registered voters. He said the sample size was dictated by the budget. Of course, a much larger sample size would ensure a higher degree of accuracy. Hopefully, the early release of the poll results did not deter registered voters from casting their ballots.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report about an upcoming documentary on Portland's Measure 9 Concert Against Hate in 1992. This will be followed at 6 by Labor Radio. Activists from the newly formed Burgerville Workers Union will share their stories and their demands for a $5 raise, affordable health care, fair scheduling, and union recognition. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline. Host Adam Carpinelli interviews activist Ben Turk about the upcoming September 9th call for a national prisoner strike to end prison slavery for good. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather: 20% chance of showers before 11 p.m., mostly cloudy with a low around 50. Tomorrow, cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly sunny with a high near 65. Today in history, In 1836, the Treaty of New Echota was approved by the U.S. Senate by one vote. That treaty ceded all Cherokee territory east of the Mississippi to the United States in exchange for $5 million and new homelands in Indian Territory. And on this day in 1838, the roundup of Cherokees and the Trail of Tears began. The quote of the day is from the historian Richard White, who said, quote, "The Cherokee are probably the most tragic instance of what could have succeeded in American Indian policy and didn't. All these things that Americans would proudly see as the hallmarks of civilization are born into the West by Indian peoples. They do everything we ask except one thing. What the Cherokees ultimately are, they may be Christian, they may be literate, they may have a government like ours, but ultimately they're Indian. And in the end, being Indian is what kills them, aside from the white people."
It's 5:20, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
No doubt you'll be thrilled to learn that we now live and work in a gig economy. That's the latest corporate buzz phrase from Silicon Valley. CEOs are hailing a brave new workplace in which we lucky worker bees no longer have to be stuck in traditional jobs with traditional hours, traditional middle-class pay scales, traditional benefits, traditional job security, and all those other fusty traditionals of the old workplace. In fact, in the gig economy, you don't even get a workplace. Rather, you'll be liberated to work in a series of short-term jobs in many places, always being on call through a mobile app on your iPhone or through a temp agency. How exciting is that? Well, they use exciting in the sense of distressing and nerve-wracking. The gig economy means you're on your own. You're not an employee, but, quote, an independent contractor with no rights and no union. You might have lots of calls to work this week, but there'll be many weeks with no calls. Don't get sick or injured, for no health care or workers' comp are provided. A pension? Your retirement plan is called Adios Chump. This alternative work arrangement is not a futuristic concept. It's already here and spreading fast. Some 16% of U.S. workers are now in this on-call, temporary, part-time, low-pay, you're-on-your-own economy, up from only 10% a decade ago. Corporate chieftains, backed by the economists and politicians they purchase, are creating what they call a workforce of non-employees for one reason: greed. It directly transfers more money and power from workaday families into the coffers of moneyed elites. This is Jim Hightower saying their gig economy is aptly named, for gigs are crude four-hook fishing devices that are drugged by commercial fleets through schools of fish to impale them, haul them in, and cash in on the pain.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
A Baltimore police officer indicted in the death of Freddie Gray was acquitted of all charges today. The case was decided by a circuit court judge after the officer, Edward Nero, waived his right to trial by jury. Nell Abram with Free Speech Radio News has more.
Edward Nero is one of the two Baltimore police officers who initially chased Freddie Gray after he made eye contact with them and then ran. Nero was acquitted on four misdemeanor charges: second-degree assault, reckless endangerment, and two counts of misconduct in office. After police chased Gray and arrested him in April of 2015, they handcuffed and shackled him and placed him in a police van, but without a seatbelt. By the time the van arrived at the police station, his neck was broken. He died a week later. In his ruling, Judge Barry Williams said it was not Officer Nero's responsibility to secure Mr. Gray in the back of the van, and found that the other officer involved in the initial contact was the arresting officer, not Nero. The trial was not heard by a jury. It was a bench trial in which the judge decides the outcome. Attorney Billy Murphy represents Gray's family in a civil matter related to his death. Talking to WJZ-TV after the verdicts were announced, Murphy commended the judge for his decision in this case, calling it well thought out and reasonable.
It was all kind of pressure. enormous pressure for him to go in the other direction, and he showed tremendous courage in ruling against public opinion.
Murphy concurred with the judge's assessment of the facts and the relevant law in the Nero case.
He was basically not a player in what happened to Mr. Gray. And the judge found that he had no duty to go beyond what he did. He based that on the relevant case law, the circumstances involved, and the absence of the proof of certain critical facts.
A small contingent of protesters at the courthouse, angry at the outcome, said the bench trial, rather than trial by jury, cut the community out of the process. Gray's death sparked widespread protests in the city and was a lightning rod for the Black Lives Matter movement. Officer Nero has been suspended with pay since the charges were filed, and an internal department investigation is ongoing. All told, six officers were involved and faced charges in the events that led to Gray's death. The first case ended in a hung jury and will be retried. Next up is van driver Caesar Goodson Jr. His trial on second-degree murder charges is set to begin June 6th. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
The human cost of automation, or my miserable travel experience. Here's this week's F Word with Laura Flanders.
A group of children play in the blazing sun amidst rows of houses on stilts in the coastal city of Buenaventura, home to Colombia's busiest port. It's a scene that would have been hard to imagine just a few years back when parents kept their children indoors.
Automation, automation everywhere. Wherever you look, robots are in and precarious work is getting precariouser. Take telephone operators. It's been years since I spoke to one. I kind of miss them. Bank tellers are probably next. Business Insider reports that banks could see a 30% reduction in staff over the next 10 years. And along with the tellers are the bank branches in which they work. Mobile bank apps don't need real people or real estate, it turns out. The automated world's an efficient and cost-conscious world. At least that's what we're told. It's what I was told for about 20 minutes straight not long ago when on hold with an airline company. When they finally did pick up, or rather a computer picked up and took my details several times over, date, time, mother's maiden name, a mechanical voice then finally told me that I would save money and time by entering all that data again into a form online. Every minute of my time and custom, they assured me, is valuable and valued. But before they were finished, they hung up on me. Date, time, mother's maiden name. Having finally put all that in again and purchased a ticket, I arrived at the airport. Checked in online, but still, I'm greeted by a screen that asks me sincerely about my packing and then directs me to a person who won't touch my bag but tells me to lift it myself onto a scale and then carry it off to a distant conveyor belt. There's a retirement home somewhere filled with unhappy baggage handlers and travel agents, I'm sure of it. Finally, though, I was through the security check, now the most up-close and personal part of the whole experience, and into the departure lounge, once the site of cheap restaurants and dark sports bars. The chatty wait staff have all been replaced by iPad-like tablets on every table, I discovered. Glowing green, they reflect the irate faces of all the frustrated customers. No chatty waiter, no barman with an eye on your flights, only a harried food carrier who says she can only respond to the computer. It's all enough to make you almost relish the crush of crowded flesh against flesh on the actual airplane. Someone somewhere may be saving money, but efficient? For whom? Not me, if you tally up all that screen time. And what's the price, do you think, if we put one on human-to-human connection?
Consumer credit card debt in the United States has hit its highest level since just before the 2008 crash. It's estimated that by the end of this year, Americans will have racked up just over $1 trillion in credit card debt. Car loan debt is also at an all-time high. The credit agency Experian reported last week that for the first time ever in the first quarter of 2016, the total balance of open automotive loans in the U.S. passed the $1 trillion mark. Consumers aren't the only ones with debt problems. Only two U.S. companies currently have a AAA credit rating from Standard & Poor's, down from 98 companies in 1992. AAA is the highest credit rating possible. Currently, only Microsoft Corporation and Johnson & Johnson are rated AAA. U.S. companies have added nearly $4 trillion in debt since 2008.
A Green Party-backed candidate has been declared the winner of Austria's presidential election, making him the second politician from the Green Party to be elected as head of state of a European nation. The winning candidate, Alexander Van der Bellen, is a retired economics professor and a longtime Green Party member. Van der Bellen ran on a pro-European Union platform that also supports socially liberal and green policies. Van der Bellen defeated the far-right candidate Norbert Hofer by less than 1% of the total vote. Hofer's Freedom Party was founded in the 1950s by former Nazis and ran on an anti-European Union and anti-immigrant platform. This election pitted two formerly minor political parties against each other after larger political parties that controlled Austrian politics for the last 30 years were defeated in the first round of presidential elections earlier this year. The Freedom Party is expected to win up to 30% of the vote in the next parliamentary elections, making them a major party in the future governing of Austria.
President Barack Obama ended a 50-year-old restriction on exporting weapons to Vietnam Monday, supporting the Vietnamese government, who he sees as an important Asian ally. Lifting the ban signals a departure away from a history of conflict in the Vietnam War towards a new era of cooperation. Vietnamese President Tran Dai Quang supports the change in relations Obama is attempting to foster. Having greater access to arms will help the nation in disputes over China and land reclamation. Obama said lifting the ban was unrelated to motivations with China and is about strengthening relations with smaller Asian powers. China has expressed approval of Obama's move towards reestablishing friendly relations between the two nations and increasing overall stability in Asia. The move aligns with the 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, which, if passed, would break barriers in trade and promote investment between countries, according to supporters. Critics of the lift on the embargo express concern over the progress of human rights in Vietnam and say the president has given up agency in improving such rights in a single party state. Obama visited Hanoi on Sunday and was the third president to do so since the war ended.
For the past 3 years, Latin America's oldest guerrilla army, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, and the Colombian government have been engaged in peace negotiations to end the hemisphere's longest-running armed conflict. Key issues at the talks in Havana, Cuba, include disarmament, the FARC's entry into the political sphere, and agricultural development. They've yet to reach an agreement, but both sides say they expect to sign a peace deal in the next few months. While Colombia's armed political conflict may be on the path to an end, violence still rages in some of the country's major cities, including Cali and the nearby port city of Buenaventura. But Afro-Colombian women's organizations are taking action to combat the frightening murder rates in their communities. Andalusia Knoll with Free Speech Radio News reports.
A group of children play in the blazing sun amidst rows of houses on stilts in the coastal city of Buenaventura, home to Colombia's busiest port. It's a scene that would have been hard to imagine just a few years back when parents kept their children indoors.
In 2013, paramilitary groups invaded our community. They took over the streets, and the first thing they did was kill a person in front of the kids and everyone. And that's when people began to fear.
Nora Isabel Castillo co-founded the humanitarian space of Puente Nayero in 2013 to push back against frightening levels of violence in the community. Paramilitary groups supposedly demobilized after a 2003 deal with the government. Colombian authorities attribute current violence to so-called criminal bands, or BACRIM, but residents like Castillo say they are really paramilitaries, operating under a different name and using the same tactics, like street-level territorial control, extortion, and dismemberment of murder victims. When Castillo saw children mimicking the behavior with toy weapons, she decided to take action.
One day, those of us in the community decided to get together and go confront these guys. We told them we didn't want them here, that we want to live in peace, and that we didn't want them trying to control us. We are our own people and want control over our own lives, and we don't want our kids seeing what you're doing. Some resisted, saying they weren't going to let us be. But when a community is united, things always have a way of working out.
Today, the 300 families that live in Buenaventura's Puente Nayero neighborhood have expanded their focus beyond anti-violence initiatives. Women meet weekly as part of a micro-business program to help the unemployed. All that live within the densely populated block that makes up the humanitarian space are protected by precautionary measures instated by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. Since they started the humanitarian space, the violence has subsided on their block, but continues outside the zone's borders. Economic development plans aim to make Buenaventura's port the most important in Latin America to connect the southern hemisphere with Asia. As investment has grown, so has the rate of homicides targeting women, a type of crime known as femicide. Buenaventura hosted an international forum on femicide last month, where researcher Dani Ramirez Torres presented her investigations linking economic interest to gender-motivated violence and racism.
It's an economic enclave where women's bodies are being violated. It's important to make this visible so that the state, the society in general, and the world economy understand that this is a territory where an institutionally backed economic development model is being projected, but where the lives of women are being cheapened.
A few hours' drive south of Buenaventura lies Cali, Colombia's third largest city, home to around 2.5 million people. An average of 6 people are murdered here each day. Hundreds of thousands of Afro-Colombians displaced from the countryside by armed conflict now live in an eastern part of the city known as Agua Blanca. It's where a group of women started the Casa Chontaduro Cultural Center to, in their words, prevent violence and transform injustice. Every Thursday, they hold socio-political workshops to help women in the region recognize patterns of what can seem like senseless violence. Vicente Moreno is an active member of Casa Chontaduro.
In Cali, we have something called invisible borders, which are borders created by paramilitaries, drug traffickers, and armed actors, and by the state, by its lack of presence and failure to take action. This sort of institutional absence is a way to kill and allow us to be killed while dividing up our territories and creating animosities.
Moreno says racism and poverty lie at the heart of the violence, which makes it important to politicize every death.
What I mean by politicizing death is that I make her death my death, because it wasn't just an act committed against some girl. It targeted a community and its territory, and its racial identity, and, by extension, its condition of poverty.
Members of Cali's Casa Chontaduro and Buenaventura's Espacio Humanitario say even peace accords held as major breakthroughs will have little impact on their work and the need for it. And even if negotiations between the Colombian government and FARC guerrillas end the hemisphere's longest-running armed conflict, the women say lasting peace cannot happen without addressing poverty and racism. Andalusia Knoll, FSRN, Colombia.
More than 800 people are dead and 200 injured in the towns of Tartus and Jable in Syria after 7 powerful explosions this morning. The explosions targeted a hospital, gas station, and bus stations without warning, causing panic. Several of the blasts were suicide bombings. The so-called Islamic State group has already claimed responsibility. The explosions were the first to hurt civilians in Tartus during the ongoing Syrian civil war. A Russian naval base is located in Tartus, and President Putin said the bombings in Syria show how delicate relations are. The two towns are home to a significant refugee population comprised of Syrians from areas affected by violence. Immediately following today's explosions, families of victims attacked shelters for the internally displaced people and burned one down. Russia continues to back Assad in the ongoing civil war, now in its 6th year.
On the brink of creating its most right-wing government in history, Israeli politicians are sounding alarm bells. Late last week, former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak appeared on Israeli television and warned of seeds of fascism in the Israeli government. The strife began on Friday morning when Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon resigned from his post as he became disillusioned with the direction of the government and, in particular, Prime Minister Netanyahu's decision to renege on a deal that would have brought the center-left into his right-wing coalition. In his place, Prime Minister Netanyahu offered the second most important position in the Israeli government to far-right nationalist Avigdor Lieberman, a man with no prior experience in this role and limited military experience. If Lieberman does indeed assume the post of defense minister, this would create the most right-wing government in Israel's 68-year-old history.
1,600 gas stations across France are running dry today after unions voted to strike in reaction to labor law 49.3, leaving drivers scrambling for fuel. Workers at six out of the country's eight oil refineries issued work stoppages, an action Economy Minister Michel Sapin deemed illegitimate. Transport Minister Alain Vidali stated Monday that over 800 gas stations were completely out of fuel and 800 others were running out. This comes as a growing number of protesters in France, including those affiliated with the Nuit Debout movement, have rallied in opposition to the labor law, high unemployment rates, and dissatisfaction with President François Hollande's Socialist Party. President Hollande survived a vote of no confidence earlier this month when he faced off members of both sides of parliament and invoked a special constitutional provision to force the bill through government. Business leaders contend that the law, which gives employers greater freedom to prolong the work week and fire workers, is not strict enough. Workers vowed to continue striking until the government revokes the law and restores France's labor protections, which were some of the strongest in Europe. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Emily Segura, Scott Goldner, Emery Mort, Ken Jones, and Daniel Beaker. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and Oregon News Service. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is me, Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter. We're at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Lisa Loving.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor hosts the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, an alternative radio, John Kiriakou speaks on the war on whistleblowers. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, host D-May Roberts speaks with veteran playwright Philip Congaganda, who is now a traveling master for the Dramatists Guild Fund, about his class called Challenges of Writing from a Racial and Cultural Perspective at Portland Center Stage. And at 11:30, on Art Focused, host Joseph Gallivan interviews architects Robert Hoffman and Brian Kavanaugh about Snohetta, the Norwegian architecture firm that's designing the new James Beard Public Market in downtown Portland and the Willamette Falls Riverwalk in Oregon City. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our spring membership drive. Your contributions keep KBOO on the air. Good night, Lisa.
Good night, Ken. Yeah. In 1992, a right-wing ballot measure campaign against Oregon's queer community inspired a concert that some people have never forgotten. It was called The Concert Against Hate, and it included some of the biggest rock stars of the day: Nirvana, Poison Idea, Helmet, and Calamity Jane. It was emceed by Dead Kennedys frontman Jello Biafra. MTV covered it on their news program. Some of Portland's brightest lights in alternative film are joining forces on a documentary about the city's cultural and political scene during its heyday in the so-called grunge rock era, focusing on that one night. I spoke last week with producers Jeff Crawford, Mike Lastra, and Jennifer Harris on the documentary, which is slated to air on Showtime in 2017. We are here with documentarians who are working on a film about the fight against Measure 9 in the 1990s?
Yes, 1990.
And so we're joined by Jennifer Harris, Mike Lastra, and Jeff Crawford. Great. Thanks for being here. I want to start with Jeff. Jeff, first of all, for all of the tens of thousands of people who have moved to this area in the past 5 minutes, what was Measure 9?
Measure 9 was developed by the Oregon Citizens Alliance, Ma and Maybaum, out of Springfield, Oregon, and as an initiative in the early 90s to prevent gays to teach or hold government positions. Gus Van Sant, Danny Goldberg, and Mike Quinn and Chris Monolox from Monkey Present decided to put a concert together, outdoor show, and try to bring awareness to the youth. Groups of people, you know, and Helmet was there, the band Helmet, which is a metal band. Calamity Jane, local artist, Poison Idea punk band, legendary punk band Poison Idea. Nirvana, kind of solidify it, you know, bring it to a national attention. With Nirvana having that, bringing it to a national attention. So the focus of the film is not Nirvana. The focus of the film is the concert, how everybody came together and put this together to fight this. And a group of people with their wits and everything did this together in Portland.
Let me ask each of you, what is your role in the project?
I'll start. I'm Jeff Crawford. I am the director and executive producer.
Jennifer Harris, and I'm also an executive producer.
All right.
And, of course, I'm Mike Lastra, and I'm involved in the production, you know, some director of photography and a little bit here and there, some camera work, maybe some editing, you know, just kind of the technical support.
It sounds like you're reaching for a slice of history. Talk a little bit more about your approach.
Of course, it's a slice of history 25 years ago. And nowhere else, where else has this happened 25 years ago with a concert like this? Nowhere, you know, and that was one of our main questions we were asking the people we interview. And I think now the slice of history needs to be brought up now. And when making this, why we're with these things are developing in the election, these things are developing in the South.